Is that the Twilight Zone you're watching?
Yeah.
Oh, this is a good one.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas.
Hello and welcome to Sound, Sight, and Mind, the Twilight Zone podcast where three brothers talk about three episodes of Twilight Zone for 3 hours.
3 hours?
No, hopefully not. God. Hopefully not that long. But here we are. This is our first podcast. My name is Steve Andrade, and with me are my two brothers, Chris Andrade.
Hello.
And Ken Andrade.
Hello.
And we are all Twilight Zone fans, and we love to talk about Twilight Zone, and that's what we're going to do. So first, a little boring autobiographical backstory. What do you guys remember? When do you remember first seeing the Twilight Zone? Chris, when do you first remember seeing it?
They used to show reruns on Channel 11 WPIX out of New York. And even before they started doing the, was it New Year's Day marathons? They would show isolated mm-hmm. episodes. But even before that, I think my first exposure to it may have been through the remakes. Well, it wasn't all remakes, but the series that ran in the 80s, which remade a few classic episodes, but also had original content. And I think I was exposed to it through that, and then later saw some of the original series.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Ken?
Pretty much the same. I mean, I don't remember much of the 80s remake series at all, but definitely was catching it for the New Year's marathon, because I was just kind of running in our house, I think, growing up every year. It just became the thing to have on. So mm-hmm. I just remember catching it all then and really digging on it, because I think the series was kind of what it was made for, a broad audience. Sometimes those big twists and those kind of dark subjects were still very accessible. So for me, being like a young kid, I just thought it was super cool, because I would get the twist, or think, like, you know, that was really dark or kind of horror, while at the same time, like, it wasn't super scary. So I kind of latched on to it pretty early.
Yeah. I also think there's something about seeing an old black and white TV show from the 60s. When I don't think, at the point when I had seen it, I don't think I had seen anything else regularly in black and white. So right there, it just made it seem otherworldly and kind of strange. Yeah. And then just the old timiness of it, you know, men wearing hats, everybody calling each other Mr. all the time. And it's kind of like a neat glimpse into another world. So it always felt like a very kind of strange, different thing, and always a little bit scary. And, you know, watching it now and as an adult, there are definitely some that I was scared of when I was a kid, and then I watch it now and I'm like, oh, well, this was not that scary. Right, looking back on it, just, you know, seeing it as a 10 or 12 year old, you know, make projections on things. But one of the things that I find really interesting is that here we are, what, nearly 60 years after the show came on the air. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Twilight Zone is still very much a huge part of pop culture. It's referenced in many, many different media, many other TV shows and movies, either do little satires of it or, you know, sometimes blatantly rip them off. And it's just funny when you look at other shows of the kind of a similar vein from that time period. You have like Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Thriller with Boris Karloff, and the later Night Gallery with Rod Serling, and none of those have the same kind of iconic status. And one of the things that I think we're going to get into a little bit in this podcast is that one of the reasons that Twilight Zone has that lasting power is that it's not just a scary story, or it's not just a mystery story. Very often there are things that are in there in the episodes that are psychological or that speak to the human condition in some way, mm-hmm. that are remaining relevant over the decades. And I think that's a really cool thing.
Well, as an anthology series, it was so much broader than, you know, just a horror genre series or something like that. It really, like any good anthology, you know, whether you're talking about literature or you're talking about a festival of something, you know, it's a compilation album, you know, and in any medium, a good anthology, there's an ebb and flow to it. You know, it'll take you to one place and then you know, take you someplace else. And I think that that's part of what keeps people coming back too, is that it's not just, okay, there's going to be a formula with a twist ending. Yes, that was a common device. But like you said, there's a lot of stuff that speaks to the human condition. And I think one of the reasons it's stayed in the public consciousness is because while some of it may not have aged so well, there are themes that are still incredibly relevant today.
Right.
Even some of the stuff I think we're going to look at in this podcast episode today, I think there's stuff that echoes in kind of a timely way to where we are right now.
So with that, let's just jump right in. And since this is the first podcast, we're going to start with the beginning of the series, their pilot episode, Where Is Everybody? Originally aired on October 2nd, 1959. Written by Rod Serling, directed by Robert Stevens, starring Earl Holliman.
Robert Stevens also directed episodes of Suspense and Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which you mentioned, and he lived about a half hour from where I am right now in Westport. For most of his life. So he was kind of in the New York scene and all that.
Mm.
You know, in our little, we didn't really give biographical information. We said Steve, we should point out, is a visual artist. And so, you know, it's funny. We said sound, sight, and mind, who's who. And Ken, I guess you're going to be mind because I'm a music teacher. So maybe I'm more auditorily oriented. And Steve's a visual artist and Ken is a film editor. So we all, you know, work in the arts in some capacity. But my two cents on this, the score for the first one, this surprised me that it was someone so high profile for a first episode of a series. But it's Bernard Herrmann, who's probably most famous for writing the score for Psycho. He collaborated with Hitchcock many times. And basically, you know, for that era, he is the go-to guy for creepy and unsettling. What he does with strings and things like that. And the quality of the score in this episode really enhances the feeling of unease through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here is Rod Serling's narration.
The place is here. The time is now. And the journey into the shadows that we're about to watch could be our journey.
So I'm just going to go ahead and say that's a rad opening for a pilot.
It really is.
It says so little, and he's just immediately just is like, this could be you. Enjoy. And I just like that. I think it's super spooky, and I'm instantly intrigued.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that is, again, it became most signature with the series is the Rod Serling introductions.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched other shows like Alfred Hitchcock Presents. He always had an introduction, but it was very separate from the episode. For some reason, the Rod Serling ones always seem to flow within it a little bit more naturally. I don't know why. I mean, later on when he started to actually show up in the episodes, like the camera would pan over and he'd be sitting there smoking cigarettes, obviously.
Always.
always smoking. The 60s. But yeah, the Serling intro is great. And here's the basic synopsis. For those of you who have not seen this episode, you're going to hear lots of spoilers. And if you haven't seen this episode, why are you listening to this podcast? Go pause us, go watch Twilight Zone and come back. So basically, there's a man who wakes up, basically he's walking into a town, doesn't know who he is, doesn't know where he is, and there's nobody around. He walks around trying to find people. He sees some things that give indications that people are here. He goes to a cafe, and there's water boiling on the stove and the jukebox playing, but there's nobody there. He goes into a police station. There's a cigar burning on the desk. A movie theater starts up showing a film, but there's nobody in the projection room. And he becomes increasingly more paranoid, feeling like somebody's watching him. Finally, he snaps and he's begging somebody to help him. And then that's when the show basically pulls back the curtain and shows that he is actually a test subject in the Air Force dealing with looking at how humans can deal with being isolated on a mission to the moon that they're trying to get started. So basically the whole thing was in his head, just the sense of isolation manifesting as just being alone in this little town.
Right. And I had actually misremembered it because I had thought that, you know, it was a simulation of the ghost town that the military had set up and somehow, you know, drugged him and set him in. I hadn't seen the episode in years. So I'm thinking, boy, how sadistic are these guys? Because it's not just enough to isolate him, but look at all the little, you know, mind games they're playing with him, ringing a church bell, having a phone, you know, all these things. And then you realize, no, he's in a sensory deprivation tank, essentially. And so it's, you know, he's totally unlocked, and the entire thing is the creation of his mind, which I had not remembered. And that was a neat little twist on it. And actually, it was another guy who wrote for Twilight Zone, Charles Beaumont, award-winning writer in sci-fi and fiction and things. He had said in an interview that when he saw Serling's script, he says at first he wanted to throw it across the room. He said, oh, it's all been done before. You know, it's okay. Guy wakes up, doesn't know where he is. You're strange town. He says, but the quality on every page was such that I kept coming back. And that's what really struck me on this episode is there are so many just well-executed moments, setups, camera angles. When he walks into town, you can see the vapor from his breath in the establishing shot. Mm-hmm. And totally unnecessary as far as the story. It doesn't matter that it's cold. It's not referenced again. But it's just it's that little moment of reality that establishes. He's walking, he's by himself, and you see the vapor on his breath. So you say, okay, he's cold. And then later on in the episode, as he's getting more and more agitated, he is sweating buckets doing it. And it's just, but the contrast, you know, it's not he's sweating in the heat or anything, but it's using the sweat as a way to show the level of his agitation.
I got to say, watching a lot of Twilight Zone, they must have had a great sweat budget because there are so many episodes where people are either trapped somewhere or they're freaking out and they're covered, they're beaded with sweat. It's fantastic.
But, you know, but again, this first episode, details really struck me in this. There's a classic scene where he's, you know, he leaves the cafe that he's in and now he's starting to really panic. He's looking for anyone in this town and he sees what appears to be a woman in a car across the street. And Earl Holliman, I can't name anything else offhand that he's been in, but he was fantastic in this. The look of pure joy on his face just to see another human being. He lights up when he's going, hey, lady, and he's running over there. And it turns out she's a mannequin, and the car is, of all things, parked outside a mannequin factory. But as he goes and he goes to open the car door, a fly comes and lands on the car door. And it's in the shot, and it may have been a case of, oh, gee, there's a fly. Just leave it in, throw it in. But it's almost a really good tip-off because one of the scenarios that was kind of common in sci-fi, you know, post-World War II is the post-nuclear Holocaust thing. You know, if you're in a place where there doesn't appear to be signs of life, it's because it's bombed out. That's going to be the big twist, you know? And yet here's this fly buzzing and crawling around very prominently, as it turns out, in the shot. So it's like there's life here, but there's no people here. And in a way, that almost enhances the sense of just weirdness of it all, that it's, you know, just normal enough.
Yeah, there's also this is an episode that I feel also works well on repeat viewing. Some of them, it's not the case. Mm-hmm. Like some of them are a little simplistic. So once you see the twist, it's like, oh, I get it, you know. But this one, there's some details that once you find out that he's in an experiment to see the effects of isolation, you see all little visual clues that pop up that really enhance that. One of the things I noticed on watching this for the second and then third time was that when after the incident with the mannequin, he stands and basically scans across the town, looking across the town to see if he can see anybody. And as he does, the camera basically becomes his eye line and it goes behind a chain link fence. So he's seeing things through a fence, through a barrier. So that right there gives it a little sense of claustrophobia about being penned in. And then later on, when he's in a police station, he goes into one of the cells, and then the cell door starts slowly closing behind him. Mm-hmm. And there's all these little visual clues that he's trapped. Earlier on, too, he goes to the phone booth. He hears the phone ringing. He picks up the phone. Nobody's there. And then he can't get out for a couple seconds, and he starts panicking because he tries to jam the door open, and it's stuck. And then he finally manages to open it and get out. But there's lots of those little instances there that just really pay off once you actually know the twist, which I think is a cool thing.
Right. And but the neat thing about the phone booth, too, is it shows that he's starting to lose it because he's slamming on the door. And then once he collects himself, he's like, oh, yeah, I kind of have to reach around and slide it. It's a folding sliding door. It won't press open. Mm-hmm. So he's, you know, he's trying to get out. And he's like, wait a minute. Hold on.
And for people who are young who are listening here, a phone booth is a thing that used to have a phone because people didn't have phones in their pockets back in those days.
Okay, I'm going to get super geeky here for a minute.
Please do.
There's a scene where the church bell starts chiming. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're listening to the sound of a bell, any kind of bell, whether it's a bell, a gong, a cymbal on a drum set, and if you're a recording engineer, usually you want to get what's called the fundamental tone of that bell. You want to hear the bong, but when you're recording in a live acoustic space, you hear a lingering overtone. You hear this high-pitched, just kind of drone sound that's in a different register, at a different level than the bell. And a lot of times you don't want that. It kind of spoils the effect. But here they have this overtone ringing. So you hear the bong of the church bell, and then you hear this kind of ringing. The ringing of the overtone is in the key of the score. And I have to think it was deliberate because it fits in seamlessly, because there's lots of just kind of gaps of silence to heighten the feeling of isolation. But here you have, you know, a master composer, you know, Bernard Herrmann, like I said, very accomplished Hollywood composer, classically trained. And here's this, you know, Foley cue of a bell ringing. It's actually being used as a music cue. And so the idea that this bell is part of the score, which is designed to create this feeling of unease, just to me is kind of a tip off that this whole thing of a piece has been orchestrated. That it's all one construct, that it's not just some, you know, random, that nothing is random, that everything is designed to create this unease. And that to me was just such a cool thing to realize that it how seamlessly it went together with the music cues.
You're right. That was very geeky.
That's what I do. No charge.
Yeah.
Jumping back to like the prison door closing on him, that's a moment that I really, really love just for sheer creepiness and mood. Mm-hmm. And another thing I like about the phone booth is it seems silly in just if you are watching it for the first time and in the context of the scene, it's like this guy shuts himself in a phone booth and then he can't get out and it seems a little goofy because then the door just kind of opens for him. But not only does that tip off the fact that he's in this sensory deprivation chamber, but if you think about what are the things that they're kind of running him through the mill for, this is what, 1959. So the thing that he's going to be shot in a space in is probably a capsule that's the size, not much bigger than that chamber. So it's kind of like what happens when you get stuck in this confined space and you just start to lose it a little bit. Well, when you're in space and you're in that capsule, are you going to start freaking out and breaking stuff? Like, it's just another kind of extra little test to the whole thing, which I dig.
Yeah. And the broken clock is the recurring motif, too, in the very beginning when he breaks the clock in the cafe. And then you see that that's one of his gauges in the simulation chamber
that he's smashed, broken,
trying to get out.
It is. But isn't it just a little bit dopey in the end? It felt like a network note to me that in the end, you know, you get that close up of the clock that he's banging against. And, you know, most people put two and two together, say, hey, that's a clock he broke. And then that one soldier comes in and he's like... Careful, Captain. The clock's broken.
Look, Sarge,
you guys like, thanks. I can see that, dumbass.
Or it might have been. I mean, I got to say, this is one of Serling's better scripts. He had a tendency to be very verbose when writing, so it might have just been like in the script. He was like writing, oh, these characters need to say it to point it out. That might have been his thing, too. Because sometimes there are some episodes we're going to talk about later on where Serling's overwriting got the better of him. I don't think it's the case this time.
Well, don't forget he also had worked in radio, and some of these were later adapted to radio, so that might be a holdover tendency.
The only time I felt that there was a little bit of that Serling overwriting was, and it's hard, I give it a little bit of a pass because basically your main character is all exposition. He's driving the whole thing and he's just talking nonstop. So I get it. But when he starts going off on the Ebenezer Scrooge thing in the mirror, I'm just a little like, what are you talking about, man? That was another time where it was like
that got a little.
It just felt a little out of left field to be like, you remember that story, right? About Ebenezer Scrooge and Jacob Marley. And it was like a really long way to go to get to him saying that line about you're more gravy than grave. And that was another thing to me that just felt like, I think we need to rein in it a little bit.
I think that's Serling showing his homework. Like, look, I'm literary, guys.
Well, I feel that way. There are a lot of writers who are guilty of that. Like, even writers now, there are some that I've read their work and, like, every character knows the same literary references. And it's like, I don't think that's how life works, you know? People have things they know about and other people don't.
Well, you could go the other way, you know? Go, you know, T.S. Eliot, where you need to speak six languages and have an encyclopedic knowledge of, you know, early English literature to understand a single poem. But
okay, so going to that scene where he's, you know, doing the Dickens, he's eating some ice cream there.
Okay.
Now, the question is he eating anything in real life while he's doing that in his mind? Is he eating... I'm going to come out and say, is he eating his shit? Is he eating his poo-poo?
Thanks for taking us there.
I mean, they obviously couldn't say it because of the, you know, the times were very restrictive.
I think you may be overthinking this particular aspect.
I know that we said that maybe the people putting him through this are kind of dicks, but I'd like to think that they would stop the simulation once he starts eating his own feces.
Draw the line at coprophagia.
All right. That's a mystery that'll be up to the ages.
Careful, Colonel. There's a broken clock. Also, he's covered in his own shit.
He seems to have something around his mouth.
Anyway.
Great for
anyways, going good. Back to when he starts, you know, really snapping, one of the things that I love is how the camera work subtly changes. And this episode it's almost the perfect pilot for the series because it really gives an indicator of what's going to be happening for most of the episodes in terms of the tone, in terms of the style of storytelling, and in terms of the visuals. One of the things that I really love is that once he leaves the movie theater and he's basically breaking down, the camera changes to, you know, slight Dutch angles. Everything's a little, horizon's a little tilted. Giving everything just like a little sense of kind of unease, a little sense of unsteadiness. And that's something that pops up again and again in Twilight Zone later episodes, using the camera as a way to sort of show the mindset of the protagonist. And sometimes it's done just as successfully as it's done here. Other times it's a little overused. I'm sure, you know, once we talk about certain episodes, we'll get into that. But I think that technically it's used very well here. And just the little zooms, like when he, you know, as he's in his really paranoid state and he sees that somebody's watching him and, you know, they pan back and it's just the optometrist with like an eye painted on the window. Right. A lot of really cool little visuals.
The scene in the theater lobby where he runs down and smashes into the mirror.
So good.
That was so well done. I had to use that little 30-second rewind button on Netflix a couple times for that. Just to see how, you know, because it really jars you because it's so beautifully framed. You think he's running toward the camera. You have no indication at all that it's a mirror until he hits the damn mirror. And as an audience member, when you see it the first time, it really, I mean, it smacks you in the face just like it smacks him. It comes totally out of nowhere. And it was so well done.
Yeah.
Really, just really effective cinematography there.
Now, one thing that I do think is a little different from the way the show tended to go later on is the ending is, for all intents and purposes, it's a pretty happy ending.
Yeah.
He, you know, he has this breakdown, but as his superior officers are explaining, I forget the amount of time that he was in isolation, but it's like
484 hours, just over 20 days.
There you go. So it's he survives an incredibly long time without breaking, and then when he comes out of it, he's okay. You know, he's not a lunatic, he's not raving. And it's a very kind of positive way to end it. And that might be just indicative of the sense of the times with the, you know, the very, you know, positive attitude towards the space race, you know, where they end with them looking up at the moon, like he says something like, we'll see you there soon. And that, I think, later on as the show progressed and got, you know, different writers in and got a little bit more of the horror aspect, those kind of happy endings were not always there.
Okay, you want to hear something you're going to hate?
Sure.
Serling, when later he did Tales from the Twilight Zone, he did a short story anthology. I'm not sure if I got the title right on that, but it was he adapted several of his original scripts into short stories. And he felt it wasn't sci-fi enough. So supposedly at the end, when he's being carried off on the stretcher, he reaches down and finds a movie ticket in his pocket. Dun, dun, dun.
Ugh.
Is that lame?
it doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, that's pretty unnecessary.
Well, that's a funny thing is because The Twilight Zone wasn't just about sci-fi. You know, a lot of stuff ends up being very psychological. There's a few other episodes I can think of off the top of my head where it does end up being basically all in somebody's head.
Right.
And it doesn't make it any less interesting or any less well done because of it.
I think his chipper mood did throw me a little bit as he's being wheeled out of the chamber and he looks up to the moon. He is a little bit too chipper for my taste. I feel like there's a balance to strike there. It's almost like he hasn't gone through anything. He's just like, all right, pal, I'll see you later. You don't go anywhere, you see?
But you know what? I wonder if any of that was network pressure, too, because don't forget historically where we are right then. This is big-time Cold War stuff. This is, you know, heading into the whole, you know, Sputnik. So here you're going to portray an American military involved with the space program as freaking out. And then at the end, he's like, well, sorry about that. I guess I lost it there, but you know, we're gonna go. That resolve to carry on, you know, you can almost see someone going, well, we can't put this thing on. The Ruskies are gonna think we're soft, you know. And Serling did frequently, and I'm wondering, you know, a couple things. You know, is 20 days alone really enough to cause that kind of breakdown? Now in a sensory deprivation tank, yeah, I mean, a few hours and people start saying, you know, they're hallucinating and things like that. But they, you know, when the general there or whomever is giving his explanations, oh, we can give them books and we can give them conversation, but we just can't duplicate the, you know, and you wonder, is 20 days without talking to a real person really going to send you over the edge? But maybe in a very quiet environment in, you know, who knows? You know, there are certainly things that suggest that. But why?
It's in proportion to how much of your poop you eat.
Keeps coming back to that. I forgot about that. Good point. is this going to be a recurring theme? Work into every episode?
I don't know. You tell me. Okay. Let's see what the list of episodes
says. Well, now that we've established that it's 20 days, I'm starting to believe that there's no way he didn't at some point eat his own poop.
Well, maybe there's a line the general has about, like, we can, like, take away the waste material. Yes, like, I guess that's as delicately as they could suggest it. 1950s, maybe whoever's in charge just gave up. Yeah. Like, I'm sick of carting his poop.
My question was, and I did my point, and I did have one. You know, why why is the breakdown manifested as the empty town? It's not just you're alone in space. It's not just you're, you know, mm-hmm. but specifically this empty town. I wonder if that was designed, again, to play on those Cold War fears. The idea of, you know, nuclear destruction was kind of the big bugaboo of the 50s right mm-hmm. through the 80s. And I wonder if that was supposed to specifically be there, or if that was just kind of the logical thing to pop into people's heads, or if it was written with that in mind. You know, what happens? Because later in the series, Serling definitely plays with the idea of solitude after we've managed to blow everybody else up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it might also be the town used as kind of an illusion of freedom, an illusion of openness, too. But, you know, as you see, he becomes increasingly stuck in the town, increasingly caged in there. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure we could probably like armchair psychoanalyze this till the cows come home. It's really a very, very well written, well acted, well edited, great cinematography. There's just a lot of layers to this episode, and like I said, I think it's probably, I don't think that the show could have had a better episode to start in on to just kind of introduce viewers into the Twilight Zone and the Twilight Zone landscape.
No, this one definitely holds up.
Mm. Yeah, now some other ones that don't hold up so well. let's talk about another one that is considered a classic, and I see why it is, and I agree it's kind of a classic, but at the same time, I don't think it holds up quite as well on repeat viewings. That is the episode The Invaders, Season 2, Episode 15, originally aired on January 27th, 1961, written by Richard Matheson, one of my favorite writers.
I Am Legend.
Directed by I Am Legend. Yep. So many things. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about it once we're talking about the episode, too. Directed by Douglas Hayes. Starring Agnes Moorehead, who most people will remember
Endora.
Is Endora, Samantha's mother on Bewitched. And Chris, who did the music for this one?
The music for this one, Jerry Goldsmith wrote the score.
Jerry
for
Goldsmith,
Star Trek The Motion Picture, another top talent.
Also did Alien and gosh, so many other things that I can't think of right now, but he was super, super prolific, especially in the 70s and 80s. And here is the opening monologue.
This is one of the out-of-the-way places. The unvisited places. Bleak, wasted, dying. This is a farmhouse. Handmade, crude. A house without electricity or gas. A house untouched by progress. This is the woman who lives in the house. A woman who's been alone for many years. A strong, simple woman whose only problem up until this moment has been that of acquiring enough food to eat. A woman about to face terror, which is, even now, coming at her from the Twilight Zone.
One of the oddest things about this opening, I feel, is that it's one of the few instances where Serling was on the same set as the actor. And he just kind of walks onto the set in front of Agnes Moorehead. And it's just, it's a little jarring because it looks like, I don't know, all of a sudden it looks like a kind of a cheesy play production.
Yeah, he's just hanging out her window while she's cooking. Yeah. Like a creeper.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a little, I mean, usually they do like a swipe or a pan over and he'd be like sitting somewhere else. But that was a little odd to me. But anyways, basically the synopsis of this one, he sets it up, a lonely, solitary woman out in the middle of nowhere, suddenly hears strange sounds and sees strange lights and finds herself menaced by, tiny things that look like wind-up toys, but, we're assuming are people, from a spaceship. They stand maybe about 6 inches tall and they menace her with flashing lights and her own cutlery. Until she manages to smash them and smash the ship. And then the big twist reveal. The ship is from Earth. And they are astronauts in the U.S. Air Force. Bum, bum, bum. So yeah, this one's definitely considered a classic. It's one of the ones that people think of as like one of the signature episodes.
Serling called it one of his two favorite episodes in a later interview.
So there's that. I gotta say, like, I remember as a kid, you know, watching it on TV, and part of it is, I think, I gotta say, high definition transfer has maybe made some of the effects work a little,
little
less
ropey
effective.
There. Yeah.
I guess, but I don't, even without that factored in, I mean, they still look like wind-up toys. And I gotta say, when I was a kid, I actually misread the episode a little bit because I just saw these guys moving like little wind-up robots. So what I thought, when you see that there's the flying saucer at the end, I thought it was like a U.S. drone that had sent
wind-up toys,
little wind-up robots to explore, and it sort of crash-landed in the Midwest and attacked some random yokel. And I guess I missed what they said.
I guess
on the radio,
yeah, you didn't.
That
you
was
missed
my
the
whole
read
on it.
Thing where they're radioing about the
yeah,
planet
that went
of giants.
Completely over my head. So yeah,
kind of a
watching
crucial
it
line.
Now and hearing it, I was like, "They're people." So when she takes that one guy and throws him in a sack and beats the shit out of him and throws him in the fireplace, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, he had it coming, but...
He did. They were kind of dicks. I will, I'm going to go out and say it. The U.S. Air Force in 1961 were kind of dicks. They just see this woman cooking her dinner, and the first thing they do is like try to electrocute her with their little laser beams or whatever.
Yeah, all my notes on this episode are like... The astronaut just goes straight up to a giant. He deserves to get kicked through the trap door. Knife astronaut is such a dick. And again, knifing her hand, dick. Like, this is everything I wrote down while watching this episode.
Yeah, did you ever think of talking? Communicating? Assholes. That's what it should have been. That's what the episode should have been called. Episode season 2, episode 15, The Assholes. I will say one of the things that's kind of interesting about this is because it's a silent episode except for
right.
Serling's intro and outro and then the radioed message from the astronauts. And again, Twilight Zone was a very wordy show, not just Serling's scripts but others as well. I mean, it's just that's the nature of television at the time. A lot of it was holdover from, you know, when they were adapting plays and doing a lot of like radio dramas, like you said. So...
Well, it's a great contrast to Where Is Everybody, just because, you know, we were talking about how that whole episode is basically wall-to-wall talking and basically from one character. In this episode, you have absolutely nothing from one character. And they both are super effective. I guess I prefer this style. This one's more intriguing to me, where after a while, in Where Is Everybody, I get sort of weary of listening to him just kind of yapping to nobody. And this one just sort of unfolds in an interesting way, and I think Agnes Moorehead sells the hell out of it.
She does, but I gotta say I had the opposite reaction to you. I thought that Holloman's delivery was so good, even when the dialogue got a little hokey and Dickens bit aside, that I thought was really well done. Whereas this, you know, 15 minutes in, okay, how many more ways can Agnes Moorehead find to go, ah? Oh, it was, and yes.
Ah!
Oh, that was good. Try that. Can you do one more take, Agnes? But this time go, aha. No, aha.
How about,
There were lots of neat little bits. Like, you know, you get the sense that those little, you know, Christmas lights on the wind-up dolls are some sort of heat ray or radiation gun because, you know, they show the blisters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's some clever stuff. But also just the inconsistency of the effects work and things. Like, right in the beginning, okay, she's cooking her dinner, you know, and it appears to be turnips or something like that. Could be her own shit. I don't know. You know, she's been out there for a while.
Hey, let's not be crude. Come on. It's clearly not feces. Unless she's been eating a lot of cheese. That's solid. She can't cut it with a knife.
Oh, that was probably written in the scene description. Sterling, imagine the table read. She's cutting her own shit. It's solid from all the cheese she eats. It's space cheese. Anyway.
All right, from here on in, I will leave the fecal analysis to Steve. I won't try anymore. You've clearly got a better grasp on it than I have. But in any case, so she's putting this stuff in the pot, and they have the most obvious, like, dry ice fog pouring out of the top of this kettle.
It looks like witch's brew from, like, the haunted house.
Totally, yeah. Right. And so part of me is saying, now, was that supposed to be some kind of subtle tip-off that, gee, maybe this is not as mundane as we think it is, or was it just really crappy special effects?
No, it's and crappy special effects.
By the end of the episode, I was firmly on the side of crappy special effects.
There is another episode we'll talk about on another podcast, Third from the Sun. I want to talk about that one later, but I just want to bring up that one has a lot of those things, like you said, Chris, that are little clues that in that case I believe are ways to show the viewer that something is not what it seems. But in this case, I think it's just like, okay, we got to have a cooking stove. We obviously can't have a real stove on the set, so just put some dry ice in there. It's fine. Just put some dry ice. Stir it up. It looks good. Looks good. Looks like smoke. Let's go. Get the wind-up robots. Are they ready?
Well, and here's where, you know, you said some things don't hold up on things. The feeling of isolation and being under attack in your own home, and you're already stretched thin. I mean, that's what makes this a classic episode and so, you know, so effective on first viewing. I was talking to a buddy of mine who's older. He's a Vietnam vet. And so he was, you know, he was fairly young when he first saw this. And he said, and I was alone by myself, and I made the mistake of watching this. He says, scared the shit out of me. I said, sure, yeah. Because, you know, here, you know, it is. And Agnes Moorehead does do a great job of, you know, just the fear and the panic and the pain, the whole thing. But if you step back immediately after the twist, for me, if you don't cut to credits right away and then go do something else, if you take a millisecond to think about it, it's so much stuff comes crashing down. You know, here, there, I think this is something that on the page probably worked really, really well, because you don't need to provide a ton of visual cues about the setting, about the, you know, the clothing, the look of the woman. I mean, on the page, this woman could be very alien looking. The house could be very alien looking. There could be strange, you know, stuff. But you don't have to describe it. And so the twist is you go, oh, wow, well, you know, I made all these assumptions. In a visual medium, you're not allowed to do that. You have to build a set. You have to have a costume. You have to have makeup. And so in an effort to make it so mundane Midwestern, now you say, okay, so what's the scale of these things? All right, so she's in this house. What kind of trees on that scale are going to still have a wood grain that's spaced like that? What's going to be, you know, the knives, you know, how are those guys, even if you figure that the astronauts of the future have some kind of, you know, exo suit, you know, Ripley and alien technology, how the hell did they get the knife up to the keyhole and they're manipulating that thing? Think about what that would weigh.
They
climb
trees like lemurs. Astronauts back then were trained on tree climbing. I won't hear anything against it. Yeah, it's one of those things where a lot of little details. Like I said, I think I do think that seeing it in high definition does show off a little more of the glaring things. The ship model, which was apparently the same ship that was used in the movie Forbidden Planet. And was also used in many other Twilight Zone episodes. They were very thrifty when it came to their spacecraft. It was obviously built and meant for, like, far shots and for use against, you know, for flying shots. Because when you see it just parked there on the roof of the house, it just looks so simplistic. It looks like something a kid made, basically. So it's like little things like that. Like maybe, you know, seeing it in the original airing on, you know, a vacuum tube television, you can suspend the disbelief a little bit easier than you can now seeing it so crisply. And the other thing is that with this episode, you know, talking about the theme of isolation, but for me, this one is much more physical and much less psychological. I mean, there is a psychological, you know, I'm hunted by something, but it feels like the danger is much more of an immediate physical thing rather than somebody's mental state. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And, you know, right, because she's obviously capable to a degree of defending herself. She's not imagining it. You know, it's obviously something real. But the fact is, you know, they've told you in the voiceover that she's by herself and that she's out there in the middle of nowhere. Kind of they've you know, that's kind of the informed attribute there. And you see, you know, as a real world, you know, adult fear, what happens to someone when they can't get that help? I mean, we, the three of us, you know, our late grandfather in the, towards the end of his life, you know, took a header down the stairs in his own house and went through a glass door and fortunately was found by someone, but, you know, just as easily could not have been. You know, what happens? The idea of being on your own facing something painful, something scary, is a reality for so many people. And it's I think that's probably one of the things that makes it effective. You know, it's not, are we all living in fear of alien invaders? No, but are we living in fear of being caught somewhere alone and not being able to cope with whatever we're facing? And I think that's one of the things that still makes it effective on some level.
Yeah, and I think what she does really well is, for me, she sells the idea that they are this foreign unknown entity where, you know, when she looks at the little Christmas light gun and is examining it, she has no idea what this stuff is. And it just, yeah, they look ridiculous. But if I'm alone in my house, I see a spider on the wall that I've never seen before, I freak the F out and I have to decide, am I going to kill this thing or am I going to lock myself in my room? So if there were three or four spiders in the house and one of them had a kitchen knife and was just poking them at me, I would be freaked out too. So even though it's kind of a ridiculous premise, I think the fear and the concept is sold pretty well. Yeah. But it does look hokey, especially these days.
Well, I think that I'm guessing that this is an idea that probably stayed with Richard Matheson because he later wrote an amazing short story called Prey, which was adapted for the movie Trilogy of Terror, wherein Karen Black is menaced by a tiny Zuni fetish doll that comes to life and tries to kill her. Really fantastic story, really classic horror movie. And I have the feeling that Richard Matheson, after, you know, had that still that germ of an idea in his head of, you know, somebody isolated, menaced by something that should be small and, you know, seemingly easy to handle, but then, you know, in a fight to the death with it. And I'd also be willing to bet that this episode had a big influence on Stephen King. He wrote the short story Battleground, wherein a hitman is attacked by living action figures, basically little army men that were sent after him by somebody related to, I think, like a toy maker that he had assassinated for, you know, not paying off a loan or whatever. And they actually did a filmed version of that for the anthology series Nightmares and Dreamscapes, I want to say a couple years ago, but by now I think it's probably like at least 10 years ago. And I feel like this episode is, The Invaders has become so iconic because when they filmed that and William Hurt played the man being attacked by the toys, it's completely silent. He never speaks. And I have to think that when they were making this, they were thinking of The Invaders and how
effective that was.
Yeah,
let's go for that Twilight Zone Invaders vibe.
Yeah.
Now, there's a secondary theme here, too, in that twist, though. And while the emphasis in the setup is certainly on the isolation, I wonder how much the you know, writer, director, producer were making a statement about, you know, kind of U.S.'s cavalier kind of imperialist tendencies.
Manifest destiny.
Well, yeah, but I mean, always. And again, this is one of those things where I think today it's timely, too, is we spend an awful lot of time demonizing the other guy. The more we can paint someone as different. And so I think that, as I said, I think it's one of the places where in a visual medium it fails a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because there had to be an intent there. You know, there was no attempt to make this woman look any different than mm-hmm. one of us. And I think that was so important. So there's some commentary in there because it wasn't yeah. just humans from Earth. It was the U.S. Air Force
right.
that, you know, was going and attacking, saying, no, it's a race of giants. We can't possibly beat them. You know, so they were going out to take over some place mm-hmm. By any means necessary. And as you said, they were dicks. Okay, let's go yeah. and start, you know, slashing and burning and whatever. And it was just that they got beaten. So, you know, I wonder how much, again, this is serious Cold War fear time. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it's secondary to the to yeah. all the drama and the point about the isolation and preying on that fear. But I think that's definitely a component of that is, hey, by the way, you know, if we're gonna go out and do this stuff, let's keep in mind that, you know, our enemies aren't so different.
Well, that's the cool thing about Twilight Zone, and it's that even if there wasn't that in the Richard Matheson or Douglas Hayes mind when it was set up, given the tenor of the times, you can make not necessarily like an you can't call it like an allegory, because if it wasn't intended, it's not really allegorical, you know. But it definitely is thematic and emblematic of the mindset of the times, and you look back on. You know, as we look back on more and more episodes, I'm sure we're going to find a lot that some more intentionally comment on what was happening and some maybe not so intentionally, but just due to the fact of when they were made and what was happening, they have a little bit of that historical import. So I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, the show is great. And this episode, for all its flaws, you know, it still is a classic. Now I think we're going to wrap up with one that's definitely not so much of a classic. This is Season 5, Episode 30, Stopover in a Quiet Town. Original air date, April 24th, 1964. Written by Earl Hamner Jr., who wrote a lot of Zone episodes. Directed by Ron Winston. Starring Barry Nelson, who I recognized as the manager of the Overlook Hotel from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and Nancy Malone, and Chris, who did the music.
We don't know. Score is uncredited, and I got to say, it kind of shows.
Maybe either canned studio music, studio tracks, they also or reused cobbled from old too. Music.
Yeah. Right.
All right, so here is the introduction.
Bob and Millie Frazier, average young New Yorkers who attended a party in the country last night and on the way home took a detour. Most of us on waking in the morning know exactly where we are. The rooster or the alarm clock brings us out of sleep into the familiar sights, sounds, aromas of home and the comfort of a routine day ahead. Not so with our young friends. This will be a day like none they've ever spent, and they'll spend it in the Twilight Zone.
So this one is towards the end of the series run, and I feel like it's starting to show because they're dealing with a lot of not just familiar themes, but kind of even like shot-for-shot copies of earlier episodes.
Yeah, we've been here before.
Yeah, basically this young couple wakes up, as Rod Serling so eloquently says, after a night of partying, don't know where they are, walk into this town, nobody else is around. They start to see that things are a little weird when there are doors that lead to nowhere and drawers that aren't actually openable on furniture, phones that aren't hooked up, trees that aren't really trees but are props. And they finally think
that child's laughter on the
a mysterious child's laughter, the worst kind of child's laughter.
Awful, awful laughter.
And then they finally think they've found a way out. So they hop a train and there's nobody on there. And that doesn't faze them at all because they're getting out of town. And then they find themselves right back to where they started. And it turns out that they have been given as pets to a giant alien child. When they were going home after drinking too much at the party, they got abducted, and now they live in a glorified habit trail for this giant alien kid. Dump bum ba. So yeah, this one kind of combines Where Is Everybody with the Invaders. You got your size different aliens, you got your sense of isolation, but it's really got none of the nuance of either of those episodes.
No, and as I was taking notes on this, at one point one of my first notes is just, comedy is hard. Because they are trying so hard to set them up as the slightly lovable but antagonistic couple, ha ha ha, domestic, you know, tension, and they just suck at it.
The lovable thing really gets
I thought they were ready for a divorce myself. I mean, I hope that giant alien kid has giant alien divorce attorneys, because they're not going to make it there.
It's painful to watch. And the funny thing is, after about 2 minutes in, they pretty much abandon it.
There's
this attempt at playful banter, and then they just say, no, forget it. The physical acting is bad. Accents come and go. It's so bizarre.
There's a nice nice low level misogyny through the whole thing too.
That's where product of the time stuff.
The husband finally admits, well, maybe I did have too much to drink. I should have been driving. Implication, if I had been driving, we wouldn't be in this mess. But since you were driving, you woman, you, obviously.
One of the first things he says is, you probably plowed us into another car.
Right. hold on. Can you don't actually have the audio for the closing narration, do you?
Oh, but I do. Hang on.
The moral of what you've just seen is clear. If you drink, don't drive. And if your wife has had a couple, she shouldn't drive either. You might both just wake up with a whale of a headache in a deserted village in the twilight.
Can we just talk about that, though? Was this a mandated? Was he, like, working off a public service thing from a judge or something with this episode?
And then this is the music that goes out on.
In the Twilight Zone.
Right.
What on earth is that?
That sounds like Santa Claus is coming.
Yeah.
No, there is. It's very Looney Tunes-esque. It's so strange. Just this whole episode, you know, it's the MSTK invocation. Oh, they just didn't care anymore. it's really bizarre. The writer, by the way, the two other big things he was responsible for, one was Falcon Crest. Primetime soap. But then the other one was The Waltons. You know, good night, John Boy. And he actually wrote the novel on which The Waltons was based. So it's like, here is a guy who wrote, you know, feel good Americana stuff, and then wrote Falcon Crest, which was, you know, the typical backstabbing soap opera stuff. And this just it swings for both of those at different times and misses wildly.
Yeah, it's not great. I don't think I can really find anything to praise about it. The best I can say is that it's kind of one of those fun sci-fi tropes, you know, people kidnapped to be playthings of a giant alien. And it's something that I think would feel at home if this was adapted for, say, one of, like, EC Comics science fiction comics, like one of their weird science or weird fantasy. It would be perfectly at home there.
When they pull back in the train station, it would need a good lord choke.
Choke, and then there's a giant kid. Yeah, exactly. Right. But, I mean, there's none of the depth here. You know, there's moments when they're bickering, the couple's bickering, that I feel like, maybe if Edward Albee wrote a Twilight Zone, like, this is how it would start. Just a couple drinking too much and bickering, but it wouldn't end up with just a giant kid holding them.
But they are no Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor either.
No.
Although, okay, ready? Fun fact, Barry Nelson was the first on-screen James Bond in a made-for-TV adaptation of Casino Royale. Before Sean Connery, there was Barry Nelson.
Is he British?
But you didn't know that.
I didn't
think so.
God, he'd be the whiniest Bond ever.
Well, he has the drunk part down, right? And I think Nancy Malone was probably just a favorite of the director because they have a ton of the same shows on their resume. Make of that what you will.
But like I said, at this point, you know, they were repeating themselves so much that even there is a reveal of a mannequin in a car that is
right.
Just like, where is everybody? Only not done well.
Yeah.
Well, not staged well, not shot well.
I'm going to slightly argue with you. Not that it's shot better, but to me, all right, so they see the mannequin in the car, right? And they're like, oh, thank God, another person. And they go running up to it and start kind of shouting and open the door, and the mannequin quickly falls out, right? That, to me, plays more plausibly than in Where Is Everybody? Because in Where Is Everybody, it feels like he spends an eternity shouting at the mannequin from across the street before he actually goes over there and tries talking to the person. Like,
well, that's because, you know, he's polite. He doesn't want to approach and scare the woman.
These are just city assholes who are like, hey, get us out of your town.
Hey, you. And they also try to use the car.
We're supposed to like the guy in Where Is Everybody. It's clear that we're not.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the mistakes they made, too, is, like, you know, you're not invested in the characters. It's like, you know, the first thing you see with them, and they're both moaning about their hangovers, and like, oh, God, I'm going to get a couple of douchebags here, and now we're supposed to watch them stumble around this town.
I know, just presuming that they're going to, that someone's making scrambled eggs and bacon for them. What a bunch of a-holes.
Yeah, they're an entitled couple, aren't they?
How often has he woken up in a strange room and been like, well, must have gotten drunk and plowed into somebody, but they're cooking me breakfast, because that's what you do in 1964.
Right, yeah, someone picked us up and carried us in. I'll bet, they carried us in, and now they're cooking us breakfast.
Yeah, his willful refusal to see anything is pretty awful.
Yeah.
Even when, like, the phone's not hooked up, he's like, "Ah, it's fine. Lots of people don't have phones hooked up."
Okay, on the subject of similar things not done as well. Okay, I geeked out on the first episode about the bell. Okay, here once again, there is a ringing bell, right? Okay, they went to do footage. Now, obviously, they threw this together so quickly or whatever. They had a bell sound effect. Then they went and they shot a bell ringing. They must have gotten stock footage from somewhere because they put it in slow-mo to sync with the sound effect.
Yep.
Which I just put, that's an interesting approach. It's like, we can't be bothered to film a bell ringing, so we're going to take this bell recording we have. We're going to take this recording, this video recording of a bell ringing. They don't match up. Screw it. Slow one down, speed one up. It'll work. No one
It's season
know.
Five. It's episode only, 30. We're going to be canceled in 3 weeks anyways.
Slow-mo shot in the entire thing. There's no but it's so obviously slow motion. It's like, it's not for dramatic reason. It's just so it would sync up with their sound cue. or the special effects for the giant. The fact that they did the superimposition then, but they do it over a still frame of the girl's hand.
Yep.
So it's like they're moving on the hand that doesn't move. It was like so, so badly done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will say that the hand coming down to pick them up didn't look as bad as I thought it was going to look. But when they're hanging out over that still frame, that looks miserable.
Yeah. It reminds me of like the old Bird Eye Gordon movies where he had like giant insects and he had the effects done by having postcards of cities and insects crawling over the postcards. It's like, yeah, look, they're on the buildings. It's pretty much the same thing here. So yeah, similar themes of isolation and menace, but not handled very well or originally. It's a goofy one. And by the end of the series, unfortunately, there were some good episodes in the last season, but you can tell that they were kind of running out of steam and they were making some that were just kind of, all right, we'll do this because we have to fill the time slot. You know, it's not a great thing, but...
It's interesting to see the difference, you know, because whenever we take a work in total, you know, you talk about, oh, that gets, you know, Twilight Zone, what a great series. And you have to remember, there was crap there too.
Oh, sure.
But that's, you know, that doesn't diminish the total of the work or what they were trying to do or, you know, the enduring effect. It's like, you know, and we, you know, you look at Shakespeare and he had some god awful plays in there. You know, ones that just
Hamlet, what's that all about?
Okay.
I'm so depressed. Yeah.
But you know, the Twilight Zone, it's this enduring, you know, body of work that's so incredible. And that's why I think we keep coming back to it, why, you know, pop culture keeps returning to it. Because it's, and Stopover in a Quiet Town, for all its flaws, it still manages to be somewhat entertaining.
Yeah.
As a basis. Give it that. There's a twist. It's like, oh, you know, that's, you know, that's funny. Oh, it turns out to be a kid. I don't know if when it first aired, if people were like, oh, holy cow, you know, it's they're playthings in a giant, you know, but I definitely don't know whether anyone saw that and immediately put down their drink and handed over their keys to someone because it hit home so hard.
But, honey, I'm giving up drinking because I don't want to get abducted and turned into a little kid's toy. I'm going to call the men in white suits, dear. Well, I agree. That's you know, why we're talking about this series is for there are lots of blemishes, but, you know, sometimes the blemishes just make the really beautiful parts shine all the brighter. And I think that, you know, there's definitely good and bad. And in almost all of them, there are a few that I will say are so bad as to be almost unmentionable, but for the most part, even the bad ones, there's something you can talk about that's fun.
Yeah, I think in terms of rewatchability, you have Where Is Everybody, which you get to pick up on little goodies every time you rewatch it. Invaders, less so, starts to show its age, and this one is kind of a one and done. All right, don't need to see that one again.
Yeah, but it is fun to talk about and make it fun is. Of. So speaking I think which. That wraps up our first episode. I think we decided that for our next episode, we're going to focus on a favorite theme of Twilight Zone, Oh, the Irony, and focus in that one on one of, if not the most iconic episode of the series, definitely one of the top three iconic episodes. Which, of course, I can't remember right now.
Time Enough my brain at is... Last.
Oh, thank you. Time Enough at Last. Thank you. My brain is fried from thinking about giant kids abducting me. I got to stop drinking.
You must be really slacked.
I am. Last time I let my wife drive. Anywho, yes, next time we'll be talking about the Ironic Punishment Division of Twilight Zone and Time Enough at Last, one of the most iconic episodes. And yeah, we've got, we'd love to hear what you think are of the episodes we talked about, or if you have any other episodes that you'd like us to talk about. We have an email address set up. Ken, what's that address?
That is ssmpodcast@gmail.com.
ssmpodcast@gmail.com, and I will be setting up we will be setting up a Facebook page very shortly, so we can also get comments there. More news on that as it progresses.
So many ways for you to tell us how we're wrong. It's great.
Yes, I think that's it from us. So everybody want to say goodnight? Say goodnight, Ken.
Yeah. Do we have a little catchphrase like keep it twisty, huh?
Keep it twisty in the zone.
Alright, well, I'm gonna try out a new one every episode and we'll see what happens.
how about we're all out of toner. No good.
Great.
Alright.
Later.
Cold pie!